The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Tracking global corruption and threats that undermine our security.
Through the Looking Glass.
This is Through the Looking Glass with Scott Wheeler on TNT Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C. And thank you for joining us. If you want to reach us on Twitter, you can reach us at NewsCap Group, at NewsCap Group. I encourage you to follow us there. We do put out information, and we also tweet out our broadcasts when they are, once they're available for download. So you should follow us, NewsCap Group. And right now, our nation is in a culture war. It's obvious to everyone here, that is the United States, in an attempt to claim that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is banning books in his state. Many in the media are citing a PolitiFact claim that he is. And in order to reach that opinion, here's a quote from PolitiFact's reporting on this. PolitiFact is a organization that pretends to fact check everyone. And it I've caught them so many times misleading people that it's, you can't even count. But if you follow us on Twitter, you'll see the number of times I do call them out for getting their facts wrong. Anyway, quoting PolitiFact, DeSantis claim that no book has been banned in Florida goes too far, they say. Florida districts have removed some books entirely while restricting others to certain grades or requiring students to get parental permission to see them. Banning is in the eye of the beholder, says Emily J.M. Knox, an information sciences professor at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. People who seek to ban books define bans narrowly as the total removal of books. It seems like that's what the word actually means. Anyway, going back to quoting PolitiFact, some, quote, people like to say it's not banning because you can get it in the public library, bookstore, Amazon, or whatever, Knox said. But it is censorship because it's about control of access to knowledge. The whole point is to make sure that some people do not have unfettered access to that information, unquote. Here to help shed some light on this and the realities of whether there's a ban in Florida or not is Daniel Greenfield. Mr. Greenfield is a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is also the writer of the Sultan Kanish blog, where I find some of the most insightful writings about the culture war and politics in the United States. Mr. Greenfield, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You wrote recently about a publisher who is suing Florida schools for banning books and pointed out that the publisher itself is actually rewriting history. What did you find?
So this is an important point. In many cases, people don't realize where the trajectory of so much of this culture war. A lot of it is coming when it comes to publishing from the consolidation of the book publishing market in the hands of a handful of publishing companies. People see different names of different imprints on the covers. They don't realize that in many cases, it is all the same company and it is a handful of companies. The majority of the American book publishing market is controlled by foreign companies. They include Bertelsmann and Holzbrink, which are German, and Legrand, which is French. Bertelsmann in America, known as Penguin Random House, controls much of the publishing. It's the biggest publisher in America by far. And it puts out a lot of the destructive woke materials, things like all the anti-racism stuff, White Fragility, Ibram X. Kendi, anti-racism. It also puts out a lot of sexual material that is aimed at schools. But while they're doing all this, they're also banning and censoring their own backlist of classics, including recently Roald Dahl. They began eliminating words that they did not like from Roald Dahl's works, like fat and crazy. So on the one hand, they're falsely accusing states like Florida of censoring books and actually going out and suing school districts for, you know, trying to protect students. On the other hand, they're actually are banning and censoring books because they control a lot of intellectual property, and they're rewriting those books to be more sensitive to their political views.
Let me kind of put this in the strike zone. So this company is suing some school districts in Florida, and it is suing on the basis that they're banning their books that the school district has concluded may be inappropriate for the age it's aimed at, while at the same time, they're censoring authors, which they now control the label, the titles to. They are rewriting the books like, Roald Dahl, who wrote the very famous one, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and books such as that. And they're changing it to get rid of words like fat, ugly, crazy, etc., mothers and fathers, while they are suing the school districts for banning books that they that the school districts believe are inappropriate, which kind of goes right to the heart of what PolitiFact was trying to claim, is that anything that you prevent a child from looking at is considered a book ban, apparently, in their interpretation of the word.
And we're talking about books aimed at, for example, fifth graders and others that really clearly, very graphically depict sexual materials. This is stuff that when parents came out and they read this at school board meetings, they were shut down because it was just too wildly inappropriate.
What do you think, what is in the mind of these of this publisher in this case? They're publishing, they're also censoring P.G. Wodehouse and other extremely popular authors and historically authors who have historically been widely recognized as brilliant, and yet they feel they see fit to do that while at the same time making this claim. What would be in the mindset? What would be in the minds of these guys if it's possible to do that kind of analysis?
Well, it's pretty simple. This is what is at the heart of the culture war. We no longer agree on basic morality. To the left, I mean, everybody wants to remove some books. We just differ on what is children should be exposed to, what children should not be exposed to. You know, we think there isn't a problem with children reading a book that has the words fat and crazy in it. We do think that there's a problem with, you know, giving a 10-year-old a book that graphically depicts certain kinds of sexual acts. To the left, to the people who are fighting this culture war, who are waging this culture war, they think there is a serious problem with having the words fat or crazy in a book that a child is exposed to, but they think it is absolutely wonderful to have a child being exposed to, say, drag queens or graphic depictions of sexual acts. This is a kind of an unbridgeable gap in morality and basic concepts of right and wrong and concepts like decency. So it's not that the left doesn't believe that there is a moral code, that there is decency. They just define it very, very differently. And we are having their definitions forcibly imposed on us.
How long has this been going on, do you think, and you're based on your own research?
Well, the culture war has been going on for quite a while, but the growing aggressiveness of it is a somewhat recent phenomenon. There were kind of red lines that used to exist in the past. They would push certain things into schools, but they had age cutoffs. They would not actually just, you know, straight up go into fourth and fifth grade, third for that matter, second. You can see this even in kindergarten in some cases, and push the most radical sexual ideologies on small children. They've been emboldened because they've largely control a lot of the corporate culture, never mind the government. They control the means of communication, entertainment, and the media. They no longer see any meaningful obstacles in their way, and they are showing their true face, and they're going on what amounts to a crusade.
Well, we're kind of seeing it. I mean, this isn't, of course, just in the schools and in publishing. We're seeing the most recent example, Target, Bud Light, products, consumer products. The Americans are kind of fighting back by boycotting some of these corporations that are engaged in what I think any decent middle class person would consider offensive, and pushing it. And they seem to be doing it without fear, even though while they're watching these other companies be punished economically for those actions. How can they possibly justify this to their board of directors? Do you think? What are they saying?
So until now, they haven't had all that much to worry about. Well, people remember, you know, Christian Coalition, other economic boycotts in the 80s and the 90s. Conservatives largely lost the momentum to control any kind of boycotts. When you look at surveys, people on the left are much more likely to focus on values than people on the right. We're seeing a certain amount of shift now with Bud Light now, and now with Target. People are waking up and pushing back. The question is, are they going to have the momentum? Right now, you're going to have marketing people and every single company saying the same thing over and over again. Don't worry about this. You really need to focus on courting millennials and Generation Z. They're the ones you really have to focus on. You can disregard the older people who are boycotting you over these things. If you stick to putting chest binders in Target and getting onesies that promote the transgender movement, you are going to win over the millennials. But companies are discovering very painfully with Bud Light that there can be serious pushback that will hurt them. We're also dealing with really massive corporations and you know, private equity firms like BlackRock or Vanguard that control massive amounts of holdings, and those companies are committed to equity. They're committed to all these social programs. So it's going to take a lot of pain for them to actually feel it and change their behavior.
Do you think that this was unexpected, the Target, the Bud Light boycott? I mean, it's certainly by the people who created those, the Bud Light advertising campaign didn't expect it. But at some point, they have to know it's coming. Do you see any evidence that corporations are noticing this and taking steps to avoid being suffering financial pain for what would seem to be dumb decisions? I mean, we have the Los Angeles Dodgers event where they had they're hosting the offensive nuns, Catholic, the anti-Catholic group to perform on the field, apparently, and they had disinvited them and then invited them back in. Who's watching this, do you think? And are they making notes and thinking we've got to make a course correction? Or do you think they just see it as a chance to that they will ultimately outlast this? And as you were saying earlier about the younger generation, appealing to the younger generation, that will carry them through. Is there any reconsideration, do you think, going on right now?
So I think within some corporations, there's a certain amount of nervousness over this. It's going to vary. There are companies that are just huge enough that they feel that they're insulated. But Bud Light, part of Anheuser-Busch, part of InBev, which is this massive international quasi-Belgian conglomerate, is pretty massive. They're still suffering a good deal of pain. And right now, we're also in an economic environment where there's a lot of fragility. A retailer like Target would have been much more confident 2-3 years ago. Right now, they're kind of being squeezed out by Walmart and Amazon. People are not doing retail shopping as much. They're already facing serious losses just because of things like shoplifting. They're estimating $1 billion in losses. So they're not quite as confident as they were a few years ago. They actually now would feel more pain than they did in 2019.
Well, you've pointed out that they did suffer $1 billion in loss due to theft and during the riots that had to have hurt. But then the CEO was defending it. It seemed like he was saying that they deserved to be looted, apparently.
Well, you know, good CEOs work to increase shareholder value. They focus on the core business. Bad CEOs, bad executives in general, they focus on virtue signaling because they can't actually deliver results. You know, one of the things you really spot with woke companies is they're often very big, They're not very flexible. They don't have much of a vision for the future. They just have this mass pile of intellectual properties, core businesses. They have defined brands. They have things that they are practically monopolized. They're the only thing you see in stores in some cases, but they don't actually have any ability to adapt to the future. So in lieu of doing that, the CEOs go very woke. They embrace every single trend. They want to distract shareholders from the fact that they can't actually meaningfully move the company into the future.
Back to the original subject here. Do you believe that Ron DeSantis is being unfairly characterized as banning books?
Again, they're defining banning books as books that they want that are, of course, inappropriate for kids, not being in a available in a particular school library. If that's a ban on books, you know, is Mein Kampf banned? Are every possible racist work banned? Is the Anarchist Cookbook banned? Well, you know, if you define books, if you define the non-availability of certain books to children as being a book banned, then millions of books are no doubt banned. But that's not what any honest person would seriously consider to be a book ban.
Okay, we're going to take a short time out. When we come back, we're going to ask Mr. Greenfield about Kamala Harris, the vice president who recently spoke at the graduation ceremony for the graduating class of U.S. Army, United States Military Academy at West Point. It should be interesting. We will take a short time out. Again, if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at NewsCap Group, at NewsCap Group. We will be right back with more on Through the Looking Glass with Daniel Greenfield joining us as our expert witness. I'm Scott Wheeler in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned.
TNT Radio's Patrick Henningsen.
A parent in Utah complained about the content in the Bible, what they called pornography in the Bible.
Right.
And they were petitioning to get this book removed from elementary and middle schools in the state's second largest school district. They said the parent wasn't really upset about the alleged pornography, but rather the bad faith process by which the books can be pulled by the state's public schools. So what happened here, apparently, a state law was passed last year which streamlined the process by which pornographic or incest material can be removed. So hedonism, prostitution, incest, genital mutilation, etc. And you'll no doubt find that all in the Bible, said the parent. And so I thank the Utah legislature and Utah Parents United, I guess as an activist group, for making this bad faith process so much easier and way more efficient. Now we can ban all books and you don't even need to read them or be accurate about them. So it's slightly ironic here. So it looks like they have been successful in getting it yanked from the Utah schools.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Have you ever felt like time was moving too fast? Do you need a break from the hustle and bustle of your daily routine? Then come and experience Sam Sam Yao Noi, where time slows down and magic comes to life on the stunning Yao Noi Island in southern Thailand. Our private villas and public spaces are quiet, spacious, and very inspirational. Inside and outside magic spaces, you'll find exceptional facilities and a full contemporary art collection to inspire your senses. Our dedicated Sam Sam family is here to provide bespoke services to make your stay unforgettable. Let nature and our Sam Sam family team take over, and you'll get the utmost recalibration of your mental balance. Discover the enchantment that awaits you at Sam Sam Yao Noi. Book your stay today at Sam Sam Yao Noi and experience our magic places, magic spaces for yourself.
Book your stay in Thailand now and visit samsam-spaces.com.
You're listening to Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass on TNT Radio. I'm Scott Wheeler, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Joining us is Daniel Greenfield. Mr. Greenfield is a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's also the writer of the Sultan Kanish blog. It is one of the best blogs to check out on the internet. I've been reading it myself for more than 10 years, and you will always find different ways of thinking about the current issues. And I highly recommend it for everyone. Right now, Mr. Greenfield, you wrote recently about Vice President Kamala Harris, whose entire incompetent career, to quote from your column, has been based on two factors, being ex-girlfriend of Willie Brown and her diversity has a message for West Point graduates, cadets. Vice President Kamala Harris recently became the first woman to address a graduating class at the United States Military Academy at West Point and use the opportunity to extol the diversity of the American Armed Forces. Well, that is interesting. And you quote from her talking about how 75 years ago, the military was made up of a bunch of white guys, and apparently unaware that her lefty forefathers used to claim that it was minorities that were pushed into service, and that it was made up disproportionately of too many blacks, for example, because it was not a favorable situation, that many of them were drafted at a disproportionately higher rate than whites. They claimed that it was the only option for many minorities to join the service because there were so few opportunities otherwise. So did she really get her facts right? Who do you think wrote this speech for her?
Hey, remember, we're talking about a woman who claimed on a national debate stage that she was subjected to racial segregation in California, not just any part of California, but some of the most progressive areas in California. This is a woman who is a shameless liar who will say absolutely anything. And it's very revealing that she's built her entire career on this fiction of being some sort of oppressed minority when she's the exact opposite. She's the daughter of two wealthy foreign students. One, her mother was an Indian Brahmin cancer researcher. She grew up surrounded by luxury. She's never seen anything remotely resembling persecution, oppression. And yet simply because her estranged father is from Jamaica, we start classifying her as an oppressed woman and a person of color where there's zero basis for that. And this shows really the absurdity of our entire system, which treats simply skin color as evidence of oppression, as evidence of victimhood.
It is, it's most bizarre when you get to the military, because as I noted before, I'm a former U.S. Army infantryman myself, and the military has always been diverse, or not always, but at least in the last 75 years, it's been very diverse. But what I noticed, especially in my most recent tour about 20 years ago, was that most of the frontline units were made up of white men, and the minorities were mostly in support. So requires me to speculate, but like they came in to get the free college tuition, et cetera, and didn't actually go into the military, infantry, for example, or special forces or ranger battalions. They were mostly in support roles where, the deployments were easier, and if they even had to deploy at all. And so it's kind of strange that we're now, I guess now that the left has socially engineered the military, it's now a safe space for these diversity hires. And that seems to be what, even though Harris is kind of out of it, as you point out, the new Biden's nominee for chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is very serious about this and seems to be hell-bent on diversifying the officer ranks and the as the Air Force chief of the Air Force, and now as the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs, will be in a position where he can actually make some of these diversity objectives realistic. I know and speak to members of the military frequently, including senior officers, and they aren't very happy. In fact, one has recently told me, in the medical corps in the Air Force, that he is forced to divert his budget away from active duty and veterans who require medical care in order to have training sessions for how to integrate transsexuals into the Air Force. This seems the exact opposite of what a military ought to be about. But you point out in your column, he has objectives for integrating the officer corps in the military. And what do you think what are his objectives, first of all, and what do you think is the likely outcome if he's able to reach those objectives?
Well, the Air Force has become, unfortunately, the most woke, the most incompetent of the service branches. We're now looking at a situation where maybe one out of two planes can fly if we're lucky, but there's been a compulsive focus on all the various identity politics, beginning with the stand down order over racism during the Black Lives Matter riots. And they're pushing very, very aggressive quotas. We have the Department of the Air Force's diversity and inclusion goals. This is what they're aiming to achieve. And those goals are to have 64% male and 36% female officers, but white men are supposed to be limited to 43% of the pool. You're supposed to go down to only 43% white men. The rest are supposed to be everybody else. And this is a kind of a problem when you're talking about over 80% pilots are white men. So what are you going to do with those pilots?
Well, I think they'll force them out, kind of like the reduction in forces that took place during the Clinton administration and post-Vietnam. But what the bigger question is, how do you get the numbers of blacks up? Do you reinstitute the draft to get diversity, equity, and inclusion hires into the military? Wouldn't that kind of be counter to what their prior claims were about forcing minorities into the military?
It's unworkable. We've seen already recruitment is a disaster. They're upping bonuses. They're promising everything, yet they can't get people through the door. You know, the traditional core, the families who have been doing this, and multiple generations do not want to send, they want with their sons doing this. Meanwhile, the people they do want, for the most part, are really not very interested in it. They're aggressively recruiting. They're focusing on HBCUs. They're trying to do everything they can. They're spending fortunes on ad campaigns. They're pressuring the recruiters very aggressively, but they're now remotely getting those numbers, which means it's basically unworkable, but they can aggressively try to promote whoever they do have, which is what they've been doing all along. And the results are obviously disastrous. They're reducing our warfighting capability. And we are increasingly unready to fight a war with a major peer competitor.
Not military ready, for sure. And we're going to talk some about that in the final segment here coming up, because it pertains to China. But again, we're at this point. Are there any adults, did you find, in the organization, within the Air Force or within the Department of Defense, who are raising concerns about this openly? Are they saying we can't do this, we can't reach this objective? What have you found?
Well, they're not going to do it openly in the sense of we're going to know about it. They're not going to do it through public channels, because that terminates your career. Anybody who has enough of a career objective is going to likely do one of two things. One, they're going to keep their mouth shut, go along with it. Two, they're going to leave. And we've seen a lot of departure of talent underway. The people who are most vocal about this are retired veterans, retired personnel who have been very vocal. If you look at Flag Officers for America and some organizations, there have been alumni who have been active in service branch academies in trying to push back against this. But obviously, they have limited ability to make any kind of impact unless there's a change of government.
You know, Ms. Greenfield, I talk to a lot of people who actually are optimistic about the United States coming out of this period we're in, that we have a chance of winning the culture war, or at least mitigating the damage that's being done by the culture warriors of the other side. What do you think? Is there hope? Is there reason for hope? What do you see happening?
There's reason for any kind of sentiment, because the future isn't set. It comes down to what we do about it. There are lots of good people trying to make a difference. If the left were to get its way, obviously we would be going to a very, very dark place. But it's important to remember that just looking back at history, history does not actually go into a straight line. Whatever people expected the future to be in 1920 and 1940 and 1960 and 1980, that straight line, it did not go there in a straight line. So there is obviously a higher force, a divinity that ultimately is in charge. And beyond that, we do what we can. They do what they can. It's a collision of forces, good and evil, which is a timeless conflict. So there's reasons for hope. There's also reasons to be very, very wary and to fight.
Of course, we have to fight. That is, you know, that's the reason we're here. But at the same time, when you kind of assess, if you do a battlefield assessment of what we're up against, we've never really in time, we've had, you know, small sorts of micro culture wars, especially during the 60s and the early 70s. But have we ever had a time where you've got the entire political apparatus of one party in with so much power and the ability to control the outcomes of justice? I know, as a journalist, I covered many of the riots of Antifa, and my attorney constantly advised me to watch certain jurisdictions because he said, you'll be prosecuted for defending yourself and they will not be prosecuted for attacking you. And have we ever been to this point where we actually have to be concerned that justice will not only be blind, but it will, you know, that it won't be blind, it will be searching for political opposition to prosecute?
It's obviously a very dark time, but it's also important to get some context, look back at the scope of American history. We've been through some really, really bad, dangerous times before. You know, there were eras in American history where lynch mobs reigned, and contrary to the black and white version of history, most of the people who were lynched were not black. You know, there were really bloody and fighting well before and after the Civil War, and we survived, we thrived, we became stronger. As long as there are good people fighting, there can be a good outcome. The times are in some ways so dark because we've gotten used to a certain level of civility, of civilization. We got very comfortable. We thought that the America that exists in the 50s would just kind of continue indefinitely, rather than the scarier times that existed, not just in the 19th century, but in the 1920s and the 1910s. Never mind what was going on in the 1860s or the 1840s. So we are living through a challenging time, but history is made out of such challenging times.
We're speaking with Daniel Greenfield. He is he's the writer of the Sultan Kanish blog, and he's also a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Talking right now about the culture wars taking place in the United States, and it seems like we have this problem with our media that for probably since 2008 has been living in this dynamic of being able to say things that might technically be true, they are substantially false, and getting away with it. And how big of a role are they playing, do you think, in this current situation? And are they willing participants, or are they merely being exploited based on their own mental, their own psychological preferences?
Well, the media is pretty clear about its preferences. The media has become, you know, people just used to say that the media was biased. It's not biased. It's simply an arm of the Democrat Party, which is an arm of the left. That's, you know, quite simply the situation here. There are people in the media who have retained some degree of honesty, some degree of integrity, but they are very much a minority, and they have learned to keep their heads down, to be very careful about what they say, because they can and are being aggressively canceled on all sides. If you can be a liberal, you can be, for that matter, well on the left, and if you disagree with any left's agenda in any particular area, or if you just commit some sort of misstep, or if you just don't seem to be with the program, you will be accused of all sorts of things. You will be canceled on very dubious premises, and that's it. Your career is over. So, unfortunately, we have, as what, you know, we'd seen in the past during the Cold War, when the communists were taking over various organizations, they would form networks. They would purge anybody they didn't see as being on their side, and everybody else would just learn to fall into line. It's not communism anymore, but it operates much the same way.
It is, you said it well. I've said this many times myself. The media is not liberal. They're comprised mostly, about 85% of Democrat Party apparatchiks cross-dressing as journalists. They're in no way, most of them are, very few of them are actually liberal, but just as you pointed out, for example, with Matt Taibbi, there was an example of a guy who's one of them, thinks like them, but the moment he stepped out of line, they came for him. And it is a very bizarre to watch and observe and also participate in as journalists ourselves. We'll take a short time out. We'll be right back with Daniel Greenfield right after these messages. Stay tuned.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
The shocking images of Manhattan skyscrapers enveloped in a sickly orange smog are just the tip of the iceberg of the impact that the Canadian forest fires are having on the northeastern United States. When I saw those images, I checked the air quality index for New York. It was 157. Not good by any stretch of the imagination. But some perspective is in order. Our AQI here in central New York was 334, more than twice as bad as the city. But just as New Yorkers shouldn't fall victim to location bias, meaning that conditions in your area are worse than everywhere else, we in 2023 shouldn't fall victim to temporal bias, thinking that this is the worst it's ever been. That most assuredly isn't true. Go back and look at May 19th, 1780, a day that is still referred to as New England's Dark Day. We have no way of measuring what the air quality index was that day, but we do know that from Portland, Maine down into New Jersey, it was so dark in midday that people had to light candles in their homes just to do their chores. What is believed to have caused that dark day? That's right, Canadian forest fires. This too shall pass. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative, this is Viewpoint.
Working group meetings for the WHO pandemic treaty have been taking place behind closed doors. On the 18th of February 2022, the Working Group on Strengthening WHO Preparedness and Response, WGPR, to Health Emergencies, held its seventh meeting. Recommendations were issued, including surveillance systems that would link into each country's national health system, the implementation of universal digital vaccination certificates, and guidelines on how each member country would be paying fees to the World Health Organization, in addition to the annual membership fees each member country is already paying. It proposed that states' parties should ensure adequate and sustained financing at the national and subnational levels and provide adequate and sustained financing to the WHO Secretariat for its work on preventing, detecting, and responding to disease outbreaks. An international pandemic financing faculty is recommended to raise additional reliable financing for pandemic preparedness and for rapid global finance surge for response in the event of a pandemic. The facility should have the capacity to mobilize long-term 10 to 15-year contributions of approximately $5 to $10 billion per annum to finance ongoing preparedness functions. It will have the ability to disperse up to $50 to $100 billion at short notice by front-loading future commitments in the event of a pandemic declaration.
From national security to global corruption, you're with Scott Wheeler and Through the Looking Glass on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler. We are joined by Daniel Greenfield, who is a Shulman Journalism Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's also the writer of the Sultan Knish blog. And it is probably one of the more interesting places to find writing that will generate your own thoughts with regards to the culture war and politics in the United States. Right now, quoting from Mr. Greenfield's column, the Biden administration tried to hide China's balloon espionage and then put on a fake show of outrage when it was exposed by viral video. And you, in this column, Mr. Greenfield, you take the Biden administration to task for being very sympathetic on communist China. And there's really no, while we're being attacked subtly by China through hacking and things like that, the Biden administration is begging for them to talk to them, and they keep telling them, go away, we're not talking to you. Is this what you're saying also?
It's a very pathetic situation, really beyond pathetic, because you've got China launching any number. It's not just the balloons. We just had a plan to hack Navy infrastructure oriented around Guam by China. We've had a case where apparently a number of Chinese agents tried to enter army bases in Alaska. They've got this very aggressive program to infiltrate, spy, and hack us. And at the same time, the Biden administration keeps chasing China. They've tried to have meetings with China. Now the Pentagon keeps chasing China, pleading them to have a meeting, and China's turning them down. So, you know, who's operating from a position of strength here? China or the Biden administration?
It is very strange indeed to watch. And we've seen this going back even to the 1990s, during a time in which the Clinton administration decontrolled strategic weapons technology to communist China while they were receiving millions of dollars in illegal donations. And the Democrat Party went out and defended this during there were hearing at that time. Republicans controlled the Senate and the House. They had committee hearings about this, and the press corps and the Democrats defended Clinton, defended China, and basically covered all of this up. Fast forward a few years, and now China's got a formidable military force and has designs on controlling the Pacific Rim and elsewhere. What do you think? Biden has a legitimate strategy to counter China, or do you think that he's more like silly putty in their hands?
And there's no strategy to counter China. There's no strategy to counter anybody internationally. The left, particularly in the Biden administration, is oriented toward a domestic culture war. They have no serious plans internationally abroad. Certainly not when it comes to China, because China, first of all, provides income streams, and not just for Hunter Biden, but for a whole lot of key donors in the Democrat Party. Secondly, their entire climate strategy is based pretty much on Chinese technology, Chinese materials. China controls rare earth. China provides our solar panels. So, of course, John Kerry has been running around pressuring, urging that we must continue to get Chinese solar panels made by slave labor. There's no way they can cut ties with China. They have no serious intentions of doing so. China knows it. the Biden administration is posturing. It's not posturing for China's benefit, but for our benefit. That's why they did not release any information about the Chinese spy balloon until Americans found out about it. Then they put on a show of outrage, even as behind the scenes, they were trying to reapproach China again. So all the outrage when they talk about taking on China, all this is for domestic consumption. China knows it's a scam.
So that is, it seems like they have outsized influence in our government, in the United States government. What is the basis for how were they able to insinuate itself? How was China able to, the CCP, that Chinese Communist Party, how was it able to insinuate itself into U.S. politics in this way?
A big part of it was simply that we turned over a lot of our economy to China, and China came in here. They acted like we were a third world country and started buying our politicians. You know, long before Biden, there were others like Harry Reid. They did what, you know, they do routinely in corrupt third world countries. They started moving money to family members of top politicians. And you know what? We acted like a third world country, or at least mostly Democrats, though a few Republicans like the Bush family also acted like a third world country. They took the money and China began buying influence every single possible way. They've also, by the way, been doing something similar in Canada. One of the big story scandals in Canada was that the Chinese diplomatic presence was based on electing Trudeau, on electing people who were politically friendly to them. They set up community groups. They worked to undermine politicians they were opposed to. And no, the scandal is kind of blown over, despite the fact that it's absolutely shocking. And I have no doubt that they're doing the same exact thing in the United States. The bottom line is they have money and we're corrupt.
We're corrupt. And they found the people who would take their money. And it seems like that's been it's worked out very well for one particular political party, that is the Democrat Party. What is China's objective? Do you think they have military designs on the United States, or do you think it's limited to the Pacific Rim?
Certainly they want to expand control over Asia, eventually consolidating the region under them. They want particularly waterways. They want to control as much of the currents of international trade as possible. They are not especially interested in fighting any kind of extended war to do so if they don't have to. They're better at economics than we are. We are better at war than they are, but they also have really very little regard for human life. And certainly, they think that if they do fight a brief war with us, we back down, they effectively establish themselves as the top dog in the region. Of course, this was also Japan's plan around Pearl Harbor. But China's version of it is much more realizable because we've become weaker and China's been able to rip off much of our technology as a result.
What do you think our allies who are watching all this take place, what are they thinking? Is Japan thinking they've got to develop a nuclear weapon to protect themselves from China because the United States may not come to their defense?
Well, Japan has been working on their SDF, their self-defense force, which is a big step for them because post-World War II, they swore off any kind of military adventures. That is already shows how worried they are. South Korea is obviously quite worried. Other allies and even former enemies like Vietnam are quite worried, but we kind of are all they have to work with, except for India, which is now becoming a rising power and challenging China more directly.
Wasn't it the China threat to India that caused them to pursue nuclear weapons themselves?
China, Pakistan is closely allied with China. The results are certainly have been explosive and interesting. For example, you now have the Taliban also facing off with Iran. They're allied with Pakistan. Chinese engineers have been bombed in Afghanistan. So it's all a very regional toxic cocktail that's on the verge of exploding at any moment.
Daniel Greenfield, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of the Through the Looking Glass broadcast on TNT Radio. Right now, we're talking about the culture war and how the country stands. We've heard repeatedly, recently we covered aspects of Antifa training, the Department of Homeland Security training Antifa, the domestic terrorist group, in how to attack and how to isolate and get people who they disagree with deplatformed. And the Biden administration has stressed over the past 2.5 years that there is a MAGA Republican threat, dangerous right-wing MAGA Republican threat coming from Trump supporters, apparently. They've called these groups threats to democracy. According to the U.S. government, some of the left-wing groups are being funded by Russian influence operations to sow discord and spread Russian propaganda and interfere in elections within the United States. These are groups that the U.S. government have cited on the left wing. So the President Biden's rhetoric about MAGA Republicans being the greatest threat don't even comport with his own Department of Homeland Security's findings, which says that there are left-wing extremist groups that are a threat, and they are funded by foreign actors. And in fact, you've got groups like the aforementioned Antifa, which is engaged in a war. Then you have the Biden administration, which has been politicizing domestic threats, using the levers of the federal government to attack political opposition by prioritizing what he calls threats to democracy and domestic tranquility. Biden's list of targets has included Trump supporters, election, quote, election deniers, and quote, white supremacists, unquote. In early September, Biden took to a stage right before the November elections, flanked by two U.S. Marines, and told the nation there is no question that the Republican Party today is dominated, driven, and intimidated by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans, and that is a threat to this country, unquote. That's a direct quote from the president. This puts Americans in a very difficult situation. Because if you characterize your political opposition as a threat to the country, this signals to groups like Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the CIA, even perhaps other domestic law enforcement groups, the Department of Justice, that you are free to pursue these people and find crimes. Like Stalin once said, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Biden has really adopted that role, and it's put the country in a very dangerous and precarious situation, to the point where his Homeland Security is training domestic terrorists, Antifa, on how to go out and attack his political enemies, basically giving them permission. This is remarkable. This is not normal. And it's fueling the culture war. In fact, it's not at all surprising that these groups are calling anyone who doesn't want to do business with these companies, Target or Bud Light or whoever, they're the problem, according to this administration and its allies. This can't end well. If we do not change the trajectory, it won't end well for the country, and it won't end well for many Americans. Even the Academy, for example, have raised this point too. In the summer of 2020, a Rutgers University center called the Miller Center for Community Protection and Resilience issued a report, and it said openly, left-wing groups pose a considerable threat, and they refer to them as anarcho-socialist militias, which explicitly glorify martyr narratives, classic authoritarian narratives and revolutionary narratives are now formally organizing and growing. This is a reference to Antifa. That's when they talk about anarcho, that the A with the circle, the anarchist logo, that is Antifa. And the Miller Center warned about it growing and becoming a dangerous threat to domestic tranquility. Now, they've since been very meek, and they've gone after a lot of organizations that the Biden administration wants them to, and named them as well. But in the summer of 2020, this report was very clear on where the real threats were coming to. That wraps up this edition of Through the Looking Glass. Thank you all for joining us. And thanks to TNT Radio for airing this program. And we'll be back again. You can follow us on Twitter at NewsCap Group, at NewsCap Group. We'll be back next week with another edition of Through the Looking Glass. I'm Scott Wheeler.